Accession number 8171, Reel 28.
Mr. Metalman, Reel 28.
Yes, now it was the job of our unit to stay there for, I think we stayed a few days or a week. The commander of our unit was a major called Madsen. And Madsen was quite a human man in many ways. I thought so, and I still think so. Okay, he was a soldier, I was a soldier, and many crimes can be put at our doorstep. Of course, I accept that. But there were also human officers in the German army. It was our job to protect this crossing on both sides, really. There were some pioneers who were in charge of the whole thing because sometimes one of the pontoons broke loose or so, but we were the only unit there, and it was our responsibility to see to it that everything was safe about it. So it was in our interest, of course, and Madsen, I think they told him off that lost so many vehicles again from mines and what we were going to do about it and why we couldn't catch whoever did it. There was a village nearby, further up, or was it down the village? I don't know which way the water ran anymore. And then one night, they were lucky. We were in tents, living in tents, camping in tents by the water's edge. And the first I knew of it, I got up in the morning out of my tent, and there was a woman, an old woman, tied to a tree. And I went to her and said something like, Dobre utro, you know, good morning. And she spit out, and I said, what are you doing here? And she didn't want to say anything. And then one of my mates said, oh, we caught her. We caught her red-handed. They caught her red-handed carrying a telamine in the night, coming from the village. And, of course, took her down there. And now rough justice had to be done. And what happened, very early in the morning, Madsen got up, and there was a little hut where we had, it was a Befehlsraum, as we called it, a command center. The maps were there of the officers, and I don't know, was there a telephone as well? Did somebody lay a telephone line? Possibly. A little command hut, a block hut. And she was being taken in there, and Madsen was in there, and some other officers. And it was a little court-martial, I suppose. And I wasn't in there, so I don't really know what was going on. But she admitted everything, well, she had no choice. Was obvious she had been caught red-handed. Whether she had done that every night, I don't really know. So there was some shouting going on in the village. It was a beautiful sunny morning, warm. I heard, not in the village, the shouting was going on in the hut. And they threatened her, I think, but as far as I know, no torture was done to her. She was not tortured. They frightened her, but she didn't give anything away. Of course, they wanted to know where she got the minen from, the mines from. She didn't give anything away. So it was decided, well, that was it. She was going to be hanged. She came out with a guard, and I remember it was a pitiful picture. A tall guard who was almost double her size with his rifle, and she walked next to him. She was bent. She had kind of bus shoes on, these peasant shoes, and she couldn't keep up with him. And she said something to him about, I watched it all, whether she would have a last wish. And he said, yeah, well, what is it? And she said, could she go down to the river? And he said, yes, nothing against it, I suppose, because she couldn't run away. She was a very slow old woman. I think she must have been almost 70 years old, something like that. It's difficult to judge peasants in their peasant dresses when they get to this stage in their lives. She stood down by the river. I watched her, and she kind of prayed. She put her hands together and she had tears in her eyes, and she was mumbling something. And I think she said something about meals and Dosvidanya meals, goodbye meals. Or I think the name of the river was meals. In the meantime, some of us had nailed a wooden beam against the outside wall of this hut, of this command hut, and which was a gallows. And when she came back, the guard said whether she wants something to eat or something to drink, and she refused food, but I think she had something to drink. And she just walked quietly next to him, and there was so much dignity about her, so much pride. She was not begging for her life, she was not moaning about anything. She just answered the question, and she was very collected. And more so, was my impression, after she had said bye-bye to her river, to the Mios, and I suppose she had lived there all her life. She never had been anywhere, as it is the case with the Russian peasants. It must have meant a lot to her. Her whole being, her whole life meant being played out by near the river. They put a rope round that thing there, put a noose into it, and put ammunition boxes underneath, so for her to climb up. And we all just stood around and watched it. If I think of it now, one must have been a very hard nut if I would have to watch now that somebody got hung. I don't know whether I could look at it. I think I would go, it didn't mean anything to me, really. In a way, it was a little bit of an interesting thing. Somebody got hung. She was quite high, two ammunition boxes. Well, high for her, anyway. She couldn't get up there, and the guard, he wanted to give her a hand, and she protested. No, she didn't want a hand. She wanted to get up there herself. Not that she, one can say perhaps she would make it awkward in order not to get up the thing. She wanted to get up there, but she didn't want any help. She had a pride, a dignity. She fell down once, she hurt her leg, and then in the end the guard helped her up. And then the guard followed her and wanted to put the noose around her neck, pull it over her head. And she pushed it away once, and then she let fly at us. She called us Nazi swines and fools, and she said something about the revolution and about Lenin and that they would win the war. And whether she said it again, then I don't know, that she had sons who were soldiers, more or less saying, they will revenge it all, what you are doing to me. But she never begged for her life. Once she had said that, she had spit out, and Madsen stood there, and he gave some indication as, now get on with it. It was all too much, you know, to be insulted like that by this old woman. And the guard put the noose over her head, and then stepped down and kicked the ammunition box away on which she was standing, and then she hung there. And, of course, straight away, she was killed. One good thing about Madsen, again, he saluted when she was actually hung. When the guard kicked the box away, Madsen saluted in a leisurely way, like officers do. But he saluted. He must have felt strongly enough about it. And he looked unhappy about the whole affair to have to hang a woman, and he has done it quite legally from his point of view. Was a little court-martial, and a court-martial during war condition is, as we saw it, a legal thing. Now she hung there, and he turned round. I was sitting behind him there in the grass, and he said something like, get her down and get rid of her. With one or two others, three of us, I think, took her down. I held her even, and then the other one untied the rope, and we carried her down and dug near the water, a little bit higher, that the water shouldn't reach the grave. a shallow grave. We were lazy, we didn't want to dig too deep, and after all, it's only a Russian peasant. That was our whole attitude. To my shame, I have to say it like that. So just to cover her, that'll do. I went through her pockets and had a look as whether she wore something around her neck or so. She had absolutely nothing. We put her in, and I shoveled earth around her, over her. We shoveled earth over her. And I thought about it, that nobody from the village had been there. She had been all on her own. And I thought there must be somebody in the village who would be looking for her. And somehow I wanted to give an indication. I think that's why I did it. I put quite a large stone on her grave. And one could see it was a grave, right size and fresh earth. I can imagine. Then after we disappeared, we stayed there, I think, another 2 or 3 days. Nobody turned up from the village. Nobody inquired. Nobody looked for her. They didn't dare to come to us because they knew what had happened, I'm sure, when she hadn't come back to the village. But, well, I imagine and I hope now that they found her grave, that at least they knew where she was buried. Because to me, that was a heroine.
I think that when you were having lectures, when you were in the Wehrmacht, that you said that you were told that the Western powers wouldn't allow the Wehrmacht to be completely defeated by the Red Army.
Yes, that was what we were being told. Now, lectures, they were not real lectures, they were talks, but whenever there was a chance, even during the retreat, and this occurred during the retreat, then our political officer, and we now had a political officer attached to, I think, almost every unit, whenever there was a chance, we were being called together and were being informed of the newest developments. They, of course, must have been very, very colored. I mean, the thought of victory was still there. We were always being told that the war would be brought to a speedy and victorious end now, sooner or later. But this occasion you mentioned happened after Stalingrad. I am not quite sure whether it happened before the Battle of Kursk or after the Battle of Kursk. Defeat was now a possibility, because anyone who had been through Stalingrad, like myself and the hundreds of my mates, defeat for the first time had become a possibility. Up to then, at these lectures or so, if anyone mentioned defeat or retreat or so, we were being told off. What? You mentioned defeat? You say something about retreat? A German soldier should not think of these things. As victory is the only thing we can think of, and go forward. Retreat? And of course, then you shut up and didn't mention retreat. But now, Stalingrad, nobody could just sweep that under the carpet. And I do remember, we had an officer, he was a very eloquent fellow, I think he was a captain, doesn't matter. And the question came up, well, Stalingrad and Kursk, and surely the Russian army has not been beaten. The Russian army, the Red Army, is still very strong, because when that happened, we definitely had retreated for a long time already. And the question was being asked, well, now, if they go on like this, and if we go on like this, if we go further to the west, and we go back into Poland, and then we go back into Germany, it is a possibility after all now. And he said, well, for once we will win this war, of course. But should that happen, that we are being forced further back, and that we are being forced through the Western powers coming in from the west, under no circumstances will the Red Army be allowed to enter Europe. We were told that whatever happens, there are so many similar aims we have together with the Western powers, meaning we want to preserve Western civilization against the barbaric hordes, the barbaric civilization of Bolshevism, under all circumstances, must that be prevented? And if the threat ever would come that the Russians would enter Central Europe, then there would come some sort of agreement with the Western powers. Our Führer would save the Abendland, as we called it, the center of Western civilization. Under all circumstances, we can be assured of that. And I can imagine that a thought behind this statement perhaps was that we all knew the horrible atrocities we had committed in Russia. And sometimes in a conversation it came out that if the Russians ever would come into our country and only do half of to us, to our people, what we have done to them, God help us. And there's another interesting thing. I just say, God help us. I just think about it. We had no inscription or description on our uniform. There were no words printed. We only had the eagle here and we had the swastika. But our lock, the belt lock, the only words on our uniform were three words for us Nazi soldiers. Gott mit uns. God mit us. And if I think of that sometimes, that was the only inscription we had on our uniform, the Nazi army. When I think of it now, well, it tells a story that we carried these words around with us after all what we did. Gott mit uns.
I think actually there's a story which we've missed, which about a bishop and a soldier with pacifist leanings who approached him. We haven't recorded that one. Could you tell me about that?
Yes, that was at the very beginning, of course. I was trained in the barracks at Harburg, which is part of Hamburg, in the Panzer Barracks, Dominik Kaserne, they were called. And I don't know how it is in the English army, but the swearing-in ceremony takes place after the training is over. And I think we had, was it 8 weeks or 10 weeks or 12 weeks training? And then we were kind of tested on our knowledge and our abilities, and we had to perform certain movements with our tanks and our packs and whatnot. And yes, and we were more or less passed. And then came the ceremony, the actual swearing in. And I think all the soldiers, the young soldiers, the young recruits from all the barracks around Hamburg met then on a day in Hamburg, and it was on the Moorweide. It's a large meadow, more or less in the center of Hamburg. It was a big show. There were thousands of us soldiers, and we were transported there by lorries from our barracks and had our best uniforms on and felt proud. We felt now we are ordinary soldiers. And there was a platform somehow in the middle, and we were lined up in a huge square circle. I'm not quite sure. There was music, and the flags were there, and everyone was in a good mood. The civilians stood all around outside. And a very colorful thing it was. And then the cars arrived with the VIPs. We didn't call it VIPs. Well, the officers, there were people from the general staff. You could see it with their red strips down there. Uniform trousers. Very high officers. I don't know their names. I didn't recognize any one of them in those days. And also the clergy was there. Because in every unit, I think, down to regiment, you had a regimental padre, something like that. The clergy was involved too. And anyway, we had to present arms, and the music played, and then the officers, they greeted each other. Some had their wives there, even on that platform. They stood a little bit further back. And whether it was the Bishop of Hamburg, I'm not able to say that for sure, because I might do wrong to somebody. But it was a high clergyman, and I think it was a Bishop of Hamburg, because somehow it is locked in my memory that we talked about that afterwards. Anyway, that man, he said the oath, and we had to repeat it in a slow way, ich schwöre, and then we all said ich schwöre, and im Namen Gottes, in the name of God, to obey the Führer, and to do my utmost best for the Father. I don't know the exact words anymore. He always said a few words, and then we repeated it. We had to hold our fingers up in the air. And that was it. Now we had sworn our oath to the Führer Adolf Hitler. He then said, he had a microphone, if there would be anyone who wants to talk with him or discuss something with him, don't be afraid, come forward. He was a very fat man, very thick face he had. And afterwards we strolled around on the meadow. It was beautiful weather. And I went to the center. I was interested to see the generals, and normally you don't come into close contact with high officers. The highest officers I had seen were majors, hardly more than that. And there was a bishop, and he talked to some people, was very friendly. And one lad I knew, he had been in the same, during the training, he had been with me in the Dominik Kaserne. He was always a quiet lad. People laughed about him because he was a bit religious. He had somebody said it, he had his New Testament with him and was reading it sometimes while all the others were talking about girls and more interesting things. And I heard it when he said to the bishop, "Bishop, you mentioned that anyone who would like to talk as you can do so, and I got something on my mind which is worrying me." And the bishop said something, "Yeah, well, shoot on." "Okay," and he smiled at him. And this young lad said, "I have been brought up in the Christian faith. My parents are Christians. I have been to Sunday school. I have been to a school where the Christian teaching has been a dominating factor, and I honestly believe in the basic principles of Christianity. Now, I always have been told that the Ten Commandments is a basic guidance, should be a basic guidance to all our life. If we stick by the Ten Commandments, then it will be better for humanity if everyone does that, then, because the basic things in living together, they are enshrined in that, if one obeys the Ten Commandments." And I could already see this smile came a little bit away from the bishop's face. And then he said, "Now, in the last so and so many weeks, what I really have been trained at has been in the art of killing. I have learned all the ways of how to kill effectively and quickly. And in a way, I've become an expert killer. Now, I know I will have to go into the war, and I will have to kill. Anyway, my question to you is, whose command shall I obey? The command of the Lord not to kill, or that of the captain who will most probably then order me to kill?" And the bishop, he looked at him. We had our steel helmet still on. He put his hand on his steel helmet and said something, I think the exact word, "God bless you, my son." And I had been brought up in the Hitler Youth. I was all for this Hitler business and bash them and smash them and conquer Europe. I was all for it. But somehow, even in my brainwashed attitude, I realized that that man hadn't answered the question. And I thought to myself, he hasn't even answered the question, the hypocrite. And the lad, he walked away, and I could see it. He was sad and he was disappointed because, well, what question, what answer could he have expected? All what I knew of later on, he got killed. This young lad, he got killed in the fighting. So one can draw many lessons from that.